Here we go. It's time once again for Ira on Sports, True Oldies Channel. I'm Mike Balsamo. Massive show on tap for you once again. Ira's in studio. We're taping this one a little bit earlier in the day, but we got some great guests lined up for you right here on Ira on Sports. Ira, first and foremost, where have you been? This was somewhat of a new experience for you. I mean, you've done pretty much everything when it comes to sports, but this was a little new.
Well, I've been to 15 NFL drafts when it was at the Felt Forum or the Paramount Theater in the Madison Square Garden or the Radio City Music Hall. So I enjoyed going to the NFL draft there. And of course, I go to the NBA draft every year. I've been to, I think, 15 of those drafts, but I've never been on the road since it's been in Chicago and Philadelphia and Kansas City and those places. So this is my first time on the road in. So I went to Detroit. So it's pretty cool.
We're going to talk all about your experience at the draft, because I know you had a blast. We're also going to talk with one of the biggest authorities in the world on the draft, Michael Lombardi from VSiN, former NFL GM. He's going to join us. We've also got Davey Wheels, professional horse handicapper. You've seen him on TV, on TVG, to break down the Kentucky Derby, which is just a couple of days away. People think this is a slow time for sports. It's insane. Like, normally it's like, oh, April, May. Like, what do we got? Baseball? No, everything's going on
and
right now.
We have Formula One in Miami this weekend also. So it's just it's so exciting here. And the Panthers are playing. You have the Heat, the Panthers, Formula One, just here in South Florida.
So we're going to talk to Michael Lombardi in 1 second to break down the draft completely. Some shocks and stuff like that. It's going to be interesting. But let's talk about your experience at the draft. Because if you check out Ira on Sports on Instagram, Facebook, you can see all the pictures. They really went all out. And I think they said they had 275,000 people came out. It was a record for the draft. It was insane.
700,000 over 3 days.
That's what it was? Okay.
Yes, they were expecting 300,000. It was 700,000. People have to realize that when you saw it on TV, it wasn't just that area where the draft stage was. They blocked the entire downtown off. It was fences. So you had to then go through the entry points to go in there or through security, through the entire downtown. And then when you went there, it was like there were businesses and bars and restaurants that were inside that security perimeter or whatever. But then the NFL set up more. It was the biggest fan fest of all time. There was miles and miles of different events and different games. You could track your 40-yard dash, how you throw the ball, all those different things. The fan fest for the teams. Just amazing. And the people of Detroit really came out for this. First of all, the weather was a little warmer. It was cold Thursday night, cold Friday night, Saturday was beautiful. And they all came out. And it was like, when you go to the draft in New York, you saw a lot of different teams. This was like 90% Detroit fans. Like, and they love their team. The passion for the Lions is there. They love this team so much. And it's really like, this is just tremendous. I mean, and it was a great experience to see that. But again, going there and being at the draft and seeing how it was set up was pretty cool.
You must have enjoyed it because you were debating coming back here to go to the Heat game, but I guess you stayed the entire time in Detroit?
Yeah, well, what I did was Thursday night, I was some of my friends were part of the Friends and Family for Courtyard by Marriott, which was sponsoring the entire draft. So we went to the Courtyard of Marriott, which was right at where the footprint of the draft was, which is outdoor. You couldn't really see the draft that well from there, but these VIP rooms that they had set up with the TVs, and they had games, and they had giveaways, and all this other stuff that was there, an amazing atmosphere. So we did that Thursday night. It was really comfortable, like on a couch with screens and everything around there. And then Friday, one of my friends and clients opened up a bar called Gilly's in downtown Detroit, which is going to be, to me, the best sports bar you ever could go
into.
It
looks awesome in the pictures.
And it's two levels, and the levels are tremendous. And it's right there. It was only like two blocks away from where the draft was. And the Lions were there the night before. Goff and all the players were there. And there's the bottom floor is like a speakeasy, this VIP lounge. And then the middle two levels are great with these big screens you can see. The food is tremendous. I'm like, other sports bars. They played Sound of the Draft the entire time. And then we were put in a VIP room there, which was so cool. So I was like on the second floor of this super VIP room. And then the rooftop is really nice too. So that was fun to be there at the draft. It was fun. I was hanging out with the mayor of Green Bay and the police and the fire chief of all of Green Bay because they were observing next year.
They're
the draft's
next year,
there.
Yeah.
So they were telling me how they do the games and how they do this. I'm like, where do you watch the game? They go, well, we're in the command central and stuff like that. So they invited me. They go, you got to come to Green Bay next year for a game, because one of the stadiums I haven't been to, so that was cool. And I'm going to not only go to the draft, but I'll go to, you know, a Packer game, so that was pretty cool to see. But I just love for that, being that in that atmosphere. People say, well, you know, you weren't there in front of the stage, but I did walk before we got there. We did walk around that stage, but it was cold, it was crowded, so it was better to be sort of a little away from where the craziness was in that center. But then the great thing was that on Saturday, I, from the past experiences, I know that it starts at 12, so it's not at night, and the weather was 75 degrees, sunny. We got down there and we were only like right before the front of the stage. I watched what, three rounds of that, and that was pretty cool to be there on Saturday seeing the picks. And because when you're there, you don't hear the commentary. You're just hearing there's a band between Hanson from NFL Network goes. It was great. They give giveaways, but it's more of the, those type of things. And then they make the announcements. They make, you know, the screens and the lights and everything, but you don't hear any of the discussion. Now, when I was at the draft in New York, they used to give you the radios where you could hear the NFL Network and you get out and hear all those things. But when you're there at the draft, you just hear the bands and all that, people running around and those type of things.
The commentary is underwhelming anyway. Everything's, this guy's going to be great.
What a great pick. I still like to hear it, but it was pretty cool to be there, I said, for those picks. And as someone like who follows college football like I do, I love the draft because it's a mixture. It's where the melding of college and pro football, because these are the college players that have followed all these years, and then you're following them and they're getting drafted. So it was pretty cool. And the fact that, you know, your teams can draft even the fifth, like players are drafted in the fifth, sixth, seventh rounds. I know who these players are. Yep. So some of the big names get drafted even later. And that was fun to be out there. But being out at the draft, like I was wearing Steeler at head to toe Steelers, and a Steeler Nation interviewed me. Like, what do you think about the Steeler draft? And I just thought that was so much fun. But anybody, if you have a chance to go to a draft, oh, go to it, because the kids loved it. There are so many events. There are so many different things to do. It's like a Disneyland for the NFL. And it was over this gigantic, like a block after block after block, all blocked off.
Well, I was going to ask you, going to Green Bay next year?
Yeah, I'm going to go to Green Bay next year. It'd be great. Now the mayor invited me. I can't turn him down.
Well, I mean, obviously you're there for enjoyment, but you're always working, Ira. So did you run into any agents, players, like get, you know, some interviews for the show? I mean, usually you're hobnobbing and wrangle some stuff up.
I want to tell you something. I did not. It's hard. It wasn't the one, as you saw on TV, there's only like 20 some players that were actually at the draft that first night. So really it wasn't that type of situation. I was where all the action was, and this is really more of a fan event than it is like, you know, hobnobbing for a lot of the agent parties and stuff like that. But
the NBA draft is where you find all the
yes, well, the players, well, more players show up. That see, during the NBA draft, a lot of the second round draft picks sit in the stands and then they get called. So I'm sitting in the stands and like the person next to me is going to get drafted, so I can talk to everybody there. In this draft, unless you saw on television, they're all on TV and they're all back at their homes and they're all where they're from. Only a few were actually at the draft. So that was different. I think it would be cool if they would ran up on stage. You know, like there was even the NBA draft, the end of the second round, like somebody's like, wait, they drafted, like, oh, he was there in the stands and he'll run there and run out. And that was cool. I think they did a bad job on TV is that when they drafted players who were at their home, they didn't talk to them. Like, this is, they showed them and they showed them hugging their grandmother and their mother and all the Fontenot for the Steelers, how he just hugged his grandmother and his mom. It was so great to see. There was also a rumor that they say, if you hug your mother or your grandmother first before you hug your girlfriend, you're more likely to be a Pro Bowler than if you hug your girlfriend first. But I wish they would interview those people. I think that I don't know why during the COVID year they were doing some of those interviews. I don't know why they wouldn't just have some of those. Hey, you were just like, J.J. McCarthy was not at the draft. No, he wasn't interviewed at Durham when he was picked.
Yeah, just show him. Yeah, like you said, but with his family, and that's pretty much all you're going to get from it. Before we move on to Michael Lombardi, you have any takeaways from the draft itself? I know you loved what the Steelers did.
Love what the Steelers did. Again, the three offensive linemen now, and they drafted Broderick Jones last year from Georgia in the first round, and now they have the offensive linemen from West Virginia and Washington this year. And Fontenot, the lineman from the Washington they drafted, grew up a Steeler fan, which is, and he loved Troy. You know, he loved Troy. He was Polynesian, so he was just a big Steeler fan. To be a Steeler fan since you were 3 years old and be drafted by the Steelers, I think that was great. And Roman Wilson at wide receiver is going to be fantastic for them. So I was really happy with what the Steelers did. We're going to talk to Michael about Atlanta. I mean, to me, I just
what
cannot.
What a disaster.
You sign Kirk Cousins to this multiple with this contract and then to draft another quarterback. And I think it's unfair to Penix, because to be drafted, it's like he's 24 years old. It's time to get playing and do those things. But I mean, a lot of it fell the way we thought it was going to fall. Yeah. In terms of some of these picks and that they thought the court, and I said a long time ago, and I'm going to say this next year too. People say, oh, next year's a bad quarterback draft. You're not going to see quarterbacks drafted early. I guarantee you they will, because the quarterback position is it's so important that you're going to see these quarterbacks get drafted earlier next year. So the ones who say, oh, it's bad draft. Every year they say it, and almost every year except the Kenny Pickett year, the quarterbacks are drafted 3 or 4 in the top 10.
Time to bring in Michael Lombardi here on Ira on Sports, former NFL GM, current host of the Lombardi Line on VSiN, one of the best sports media shows that you're ever going to hear. So check them out on VSiN. Michael, before I turn you over to Ira, I got a question for you, and I want to know what goes into trading down. And the reason I ask this is I'm a Giants fan, and you know, you watch David Gettleman for years take guys with day two and three draft grades in the first round, and it's like, if that's your guy, I get it, but why not try to acquire more picks? And I'm looking at the draft over the weekend, seeing guys go a lot earlier than I thought they were going to go. So how hard is it to pull off a trade down? Is it easy, or is it just sometimes you just can't find a suitor when you do want to move back, say, 10-12 picks?
Well, you can find somebody. Then the price, it depending on what you're asking for and the law of supply and demand, if there's a high price. You trade down, you know, we don't talk enough about this on the draft shows, but there's two boards in any NFL draft room. There's the vertical board ranking of the position, and then there's the horizontal board as the positions relate to one another. So do you take a corner who we graded a 62, or do we take the receiver we graded 62? That's where. So let's take Buffalo as an example. Buffalo's sitting there at, 29? And they probably had four or five players that they liked that they could have easily picked in the first round, or they could have moved to the top of the second and got a four-year contract much cheaper without the fifth year and got exactly the same player. Now, you don't know who the player is. You can't fill in the name, but you have the same value of player. And that's when trade downs usually occur. You know, if you're a team like, say, Washington, and you're trying to get more picks, or Arizona, you know, clearly Arizona wasn't going to move away from Harrison because they had him graded high enough that it would only take a great trade. But if you have a lot of players in that category, then certainly trading down is an option, because the more bullets you have to turn in, the more ability picks you have, the better chance you have to hit a three-run homer.
Ira, what do you have for Michael?
Michael, thanks a lot for coming on Ira on Sports. The book you had, Football Done Right, we had you on in September. What's your response? I mean, I love the book, but what has been the response from the NFL community about the book? And you had a lot of, you know, rankings and those things. I'm sure you got some blowback from some of your predictions, your statements.
You know, it's funny. I haven't, you know, all the guys that are on the Hall of Fame committee haven't really reached out. Like, I thought the book for the criteria for coaches would draw a conversation, and it hasn't done that yet. I don't think they want to have that conversation. I think they enjoy arguing over things that doesn't have a criteria. I mean, I've sent it to all the people on the Hall of Fame committee, with the exception of a couple that I don't particularly care what they think of the book anyway. So, you know, and I just felt like, you know, that would draw the conversation. Because I think, to me, we're all going to rank them differently, Ira. But I think the coaches, we need a criteria. Why is George Allen in the Hall of Fame? No Super Bowl wins, very limited years of coaching as a head coach, and Mike Shanahan with two Super Bowl wins, isn't it? Is that because John Elway gets no credit for the wins when Elway couldn't win with Reeves? Why is Dan Reeves not in? Why is Marty Schottenheimer not in? I don't think they want to have that conversation, because they're not interested in the facts. They're interested in promoting people that they want to see in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I loved your statements about, especially about the coaches in the book. And, you know, I encourage you, it's still out. I think it's in paperback now. It's a Football Done
Not
Right.
Not yet. No, it won't come out to pay. It's a perfect Father's Day gift for anybody. If you love the NFL, if you love, you know, like we were just like, if you love the NFL draft, there's a whole section in there on how the draft got started. There's a whole section about the draft picks. There's a whole section about mock drafts. I'm not saying it has all the answers, but it'll certainly lead you to more questions.
That's great. And the one question I had is, I was at the draft. I was in Detroit. It was awesome. What an amazing experience to be there. But I watched some of it on TV and some of them live. But when you watch the draft rooms, and I know we've watched Kevin Costner's movie, but it seemed like the rooms looked a little different. You know, LA Rams looked like they were having fun at a beach house, and other people, the Cowboys looked like they were in a science fiction movie. How are they set up? And like the Steelers looked like they were in someone's office. It was so crowded. It's like there was no more room. But actually, how do these rooms really work? You've sat in four of them. I mean, more than four in terms of your years of being the personnel director of so many teams.
Well, you know, it depends on how many people you want to have in the room. Sometimes if you have, you know, a lot of people in the room and something goes wrong, then you got a lot of leaks out there in terms of what could possibly happen. And I think, to me, all the rooms that I've been in have been relatively small. Sometimes the coaches aren't in the room. They're in another room. They get called in predicated on on what's going to happen at a certain time of the draft. But I think it's got to be leaner and more efficient. The one thing that always cracks me up, Ira, is like Washington when they high-fived each other after they turned Jaden Daniels in. Like, they knew they were picking James. Did it really require a high-five? Did that really require hugging everybody to be hugged? I didn't understand that. Like, I got nothing against hugging. You know, I hug my granddaughter and grandkids all the time. But, like, we're picking this guy. Why are we hugging?
Well, I know we're going to get to this one, but I noticed that the Atlanta draft room did have some little kids in the room, and I saw one of the kids at the computer, and I don't know if that pick was someone, you know, they pushed the wrong button, you know, to get that, because that might be the only room I saw with kids, like, in front of the computer, which I didn't think was the smartest thing.
That might have helped them, actually, if they would have had a child in front of the computer, because, look, here's the reality. You know, you could take Michael Penix, and nobody would argue with that pick, and you could sign Kirk Cousins, and nobody argued with that selection. But the two of them don't make a good idea because you can't play two. It's like a guy who has limited money decides he wants to use his resources to buy a second Rolex. Like, you can't buy two. You don't wear two Rolexes. You can only wear one. Why are you wasting your money on another Rolex? And so that, to me, was the real issue. And here's the other thing. I think nobody understands this. I do. People in the league do, too. I call him Terry Super Bowl winning GM Fontenot, who's never won a Super Bowl in his life, but yet he was the one interviewing Bill Belichick as if he would really know Belichick's football acumen. Right, I got that. Okay. Well, let's go forward. You know, I mean, like, let's look at this. You've got a situation where you're in October, right? You know you need a quarterback. I mean, I'm watching all the Falcon games. I know they need a quarterback. They're not playing very well. And now, you know, so do your homework on Michael Penix. He was at the Senior Bowl. Do your homework on him. You know, why wouldn't you just sit there and said, look, we'll take Michael Penix in the first round. We could trade up to get Michael Penix in the first round, right? Like, why did we have to spend $100 million of Arthur Blank's money and then pick this guy? It makes no sense at all in terms of how you structure your team and how you put together your team.
Yeah, I mean, the question is, they signed Cousins, and then they knew they were drafting eight. It wasn't like it was right. It wasn't like they're surprised. And also, they're like, well, they had a chance to evaluate Penix. Well, I mean, I watched Penix play 15 games this year. You know, I'm sure there's some analysis, but I mean, it's like you saw Michael Penix. He wasn't from some small school that no one ever heard about. He's played in the national championship game, and
when I first started in the league in 1984. There was three tapes on Jerry Rice. When Bill Walsh watched him play in Houston in October, a game in October, we were playing the Oilers the next day. In his TV room, he had on a football game, Texas Southern playing Mississippi Valley over at the Hastroville. And he calls me up into his room. He says, hey, Michael, get me every tape you can on this Mississippi Valley receiver. Okay, coach, I got it. Call back. I call. There's only three canisters of tape, right? So we had him for pretty much 4 months. I kept him in his office. But that was then. Today, I can sit here in this office and I can watch every Washington tape I want to see. I can watch them all. They're all videotapes. They're not 16 millimeter. So to have an excuse to basically come out to the press conference and say, well, you know, we went and worked him out and he blew us away. He was at the Senior Bowl. He didn't blow you away there. He was at the Combine. He didn't blow you away there. Like, at some point, stop insulting my intelligence.
I want to ask you also the one question. I have so many questions. It's that A.D. Mitchell was dropped a little bit in the draft. Not so much. He was the late first round, middle of the second, he dropped to. But then Chris Ballard, the general manager of the Colts, started criticizing people, saying, oh, the rumors that he didn't interview well was inappropriate. And he's like yelling at everybody for it. And I'm like, I don't remember the Dolphins when Marino dropped in their laps, you know, complained that, oh my gosh, Dan Marino got some bad rumors. And you know, now we have a quarterback, a Hall of Fame quarterback for 20 years. I just think, why didn't you just say, hey, it's great. I'm so happy we got him. We love him. He's going to be great receiver for us. You can't wait to have him in the building.
Well, I'm probably sure his media was giving him a hard time for taking a guy who's a character risk. So I felt like he needed to defend himself on the pick because, you know, like, look, Dan Marino, and this is in my book, Football Done Right, the reason he's a Miami Dolphin is because some stupid newspaper in Pittsburgh put out a horrible rumor that even Marvin Demault, the agent for Dan Marino, couldn't put out. And so it just spread like wildfire. You know, and it's the same thing with some of these kids. And what I think Chris was trying to say was, look, if the kid's got a kind of an issue, put your name on it. You know, it's like that column that they wrote about Belichick and why he didn't get hired in Atlanta. I'm the only guy quoted in the column. I'm the only guy. Everybody else is behind the scenes, hiding behind there. You know, and then somebody from Atlanta said he couldn't make it into their top three. They actually bragged about that. He's got six Super Bowl trophies. He's been to eight. You've never been to any. I mean, you've never won any, and you're sitting there evaluating him, and you're saying that, you know, he couldn't finish in your top three? That's absurd.
The first quarterback was Caleb Williams. Is he that can't miss? Is he the Andrew Luck, Trevor Lawrence type of talent?
Well, Trevor Lawrence has missed. I mean, Trevor Lawrence has an average over 7.1 yards per attempt in his career. I mean, he's got to throw the ball down the field. I know they picked up his fifth-year option. They had to do that, but I thought Trevor Lawrence was can't miss. And I still think Trevor Lawrence can be a good player, but, man, he's too inconsistent with everything he does in terms of his footwork, his fundamentals, all those things. And, you know, they've got to be able to find a way to get the ball down the field. You just can't win in the National Football League averaging 7.1 yards per attempt. But going back to Caleb Williams, the reality of it is, you know, the reason he went and spent time with a bunch of the Bears players is because they want to make sure there's a connectivity between him and the players. And we see this a lot. You know, Kyler Murray doesn't connect with his teammates. They're trying. They're trying to. But part of being a quarterback is when you get in that huddle, everybody's got to be able to buy into you. Bill Walsh used to say this. Steve Young talked about this. Steve Young said the one thing he learned from Bill Walsh was when I got in the huddle, there's a minute to go. We're down by 4 points. I've got to be able to look at everybody in that huddle and let them know we can win this game, and we'll win it together. And I think some quarterbacks, like Mac Jones last year, like Kyler Murray in Arizona, sometimes they don't have that connectivity, and it affects their career as much as anybody.
And in the number two pick, the Jaden Daniels, Drake May decision, what do you think pushed Washington over the edge in terms of choosing Daniels over May?
I think the tape, the production on the tape, because Drake May's production on tape is very inconsistent. There's great potential in Drake May, but there's too many plays that are bad, too many bad plays. And you've got to say to yourself, can I fix those plays? Can I improve the player in this area? That's the challenge that you have, and that's the hard part. You know, the one thing that gets all us personnel guys fired is potential. You know, potential gets you fired, because if you don't realize the potential, you're fired. And so I think that's probably why they did that.
And someone with some potential, I'm going to jump to the sixth pick, was the Giants fans. I mean, it seemed like there was this thought that they'd move off from Daniel Jones. A couple quarterbacks were still left at that time, but they take Malik Nabers instead of wide receivers, sort of giving a vote of confidence, would it say, to Daniel Jones? Or what was the Giants thinking, you think, there?
Well, I think you have to go back, and I wrote about this on VSiN.com. If you go there, I wrote a column a month ago when John Mara, the president of the Giants, said they asked him about would they take somebody over with Daniel Jones, and nobody loves Daniel Jones, maybe that, other than Daniel Jones' parents, than John Mara. Nobody loves him more than he does. And so he made a great statement. He said, look, if these guys fall in love, and he used the word love, with a player, I won't hold them back from trading up or from picking them. And I think that when push came to shove, the only person that Daboll and Joe Shane fell in love with was Drake May. That was it. They didn't love – they liked J.J. McCarthy. They didn't love him. And so because they didn't love him, they weren't going to pick him.
Well, let's talk about a team that loved J.J. McCarthy, which was the Vikings. It sort of helped, you know, that he fell to, they just moved up one pick, but they seem enthusiastic. And you know, McCarthy is the one where I think he's the most divisive of all the quarterbacks. A lot of people, you know, I just drove in and Colin Cowherd's bashing him, you know, doesn't know if he's going to work out so well. But I think that's the one question mark in terms of the draft where, you know, some people say he's going to be great and others don't think he's going to do, because he didn't really throw the ball as much in Michigan, was asked to do so much.
Yeah, they kind of cut back. You know, anytime the game got hard, they cut back, and they didn't really ask him to do a lot. You know, we'll see. Look, I think a lot of this, too, guys, is the ability of the coach to develop the player, right? And you got to have the right offense, the right system. You've got to have the right coach. Like Sean Payton will do a good job with Bo Nix because he's got so much at stake in that area. I think there goes a lot to that. I think it's really important. And you know, and McCarthy's smart. You know, he was really good on third down, which is a down that you looked at in terms of evaluations. Thought he did a good job in that area. But I think the reality here is you know, they're not going to put all the pressure on him, and Kevin O'Connell's going to protect him. That's a part of a job of a coordinator. I mean, last year in Washington, Sam Howell did some really good things, except that the fact that they were 32nd in running attempts and 7th in the average per rush. They got the kid killed. And so that makes it really hard.
I think Sam Howell led the league in rushing in terms of just running around so much. Anytime you saw it on TV, he was running around.
I mean, they were 7th in yards per attempt rushing last year, 32nd in rushing attempts, which means they could run for a good average per carry, but they never called any runs because they just got preoccupied with calling pass plays. They were playing Madden in their basement.
And then the Brock Purdy, you know, drafting in terms of him being a star for the 49ers, we look at the end of the draft. I mean, it was surprising that the draft Spencer Rattler wasn't drafted the 5th round. A lot of question marks with Rattler, and then Jordan Travis and Milton and Leary and Pratt. Anyone from those last type of picks from quarterbacks that might not going to be Brock Purdy, but you might see some potential out of?
You know, it's going to be a hard one. I didn't think it was a draft that had, you know, somebody, George Payton from the Broncos said that he thought there were 8 starters in this draft, and there's never 8 starting quarterbacks in any draft. There's not 8 starting quarterbacks in 8 drafts, let alone just in one, you know? So I didn't see that. I think they're all, I mean, Spencer Rattler's a good college player, 6 feet tall, runs 5'1", hard to make a lot of plays in the NFL without great size and speed.
And then moving to the receivers, I mean, there was such a run from like 23 to 37, I think 7 or 8 picks were the receivers. And after Harrison went to the Cards, Nabers to Giants, and Odunze he went. Then which receivers do you think fell into the great situation in terms of their talent? Like, I mean, I'll give you an example. I'm a Steeler fan. I love Roman Wilson of the Steelers. We desperately need a wide receiver. I think he fits in great with that team. Which of these other receivers that fell between like 23 and like the 4th round, do you think it looks great for, they got a great situation?
Well, I think Pearsall from the 49ers certainly does. We'll see what happens with Worthy in Kansas City, because to me, he's a little bit of a gadget player. When he comes on the field, everybody knows he's going to get the ball. He's going to have to prove he can play down in and down out. You know, with Coleman, the kid that Florida State had that went to Buffalo at the top of the 2nd, he's going to get right in there and play right away. So we'll see what he can do. I love Pittsburgh's draft. I think Pittsburgh had one of the best drafts. They drafted 2 starting offensive linemen. They got themselves the 3rd receiver who can run with it after the catch. They got probably one of the best defensive players in the 3rd round in Peyton Wilson, if he can stay healthy. It gives them a linebacker along with Patrick Queen that they really haven't had, that inside line. They've been trying to fix that inside linebacker position since Ryan Shazier left.
Right. I mean, I'm pumped. I think I'm excited. Even the offensive line. Do you think there's something with the Steelers, the offensive line, in terms of how much offensive linemen cost? You talk about saving money on quarterbacks, but by having all now, you know, Broderick Jones from last year, now having 3 rookie offensive linemen that all potentially will start, they're really saving money by not having to overspend on their offensive line.
Yeah, well, you can't afford to buy offensive linemen in the open market. They're just not out there. What good lineman makes it to the market, right? Penny Sewell just signed a huge contract with Detroit. I mean, you're sitting there, you're in Miami. You know how, look, they have to run a certain scheme to protect their offensive line. It's hard to find linemen. Robert Hunt, who, you know, got $20 million a year when he made it to the market. I wouldn't say Robert Hunt was a guy that everybody thought was an elite Pro Bowl offensive guard, but he got paid $20 million a year. $20 million a year.
Well, let's turn to the Miami draft. I mean, Chop Robinson from Penn State, Patrick Paul, the offensive tackle from Houston. And I was surprised by Jalen Wright, drafted a running back when it seemed like they had Chain and Mostert already at running back.
Yeah, I mean, that one surprised me as well. Look, I think that, you know, that they have to improve coming off the injury with Chubb and Phillips. I mean, their pass rush, I think that's, you know, Chop Robinson certainly can help them in that area. And, you know, the offensive linemen, I mean, they're going to have to really improve in that offensive line. Look, they do a great job of hiding their line. The ball comes out so quick, you know. But when the ball wasn't coming out quick, that line became a liability. And we know when he's under pressure, Tua is under pressure, that becomes a problem. So, look, you know, getting Patrick Paul, I mean, we know Armstead's a good player, but he doesn't play all the time. So somebody's got to play left tackle.
And then Jacksonville, a team up north, as they say, between Michigan and Ohio State. I was surprised. I looked down their list, and like they just like SEC schools. 7 of their 9 picks were all from SEC schools. But Brian Thomas at wide receiver, they're trying to get this offense. I mean, I remember he thought that offense was going to be so explosive last year and had all the problems. And that's, of course, we just talked about Trevor Lawrence.
Well, I mean, you know, I don't know why they didn't draft a corner. I'm not in love with their offensive line either. Now, they think Mitch Marsh can go in there and play. But I think to me, they needed a corner. I know they're counting on Ronald Darby to be a player. I'm not sure that can work. Tyson Campbell's an outstanding player, whether that they can get that. I thought they needed to go defense. I didn't understand the Brian Thomas pick, really, because with Kirk and Davis and Duvernay and Zay Jones, how's he getting on the field? I don't think he's going to beat those guys out as a rookie.
And then Tampa did have as many picks, but in terms of they've drafted the center from Duke, which people thought were going to go to the Steelers. I saw it, and also an edge rusher, Braswell from Bama. How do you think Tampa did in their draft?
Well, look, I think Tampa did exactly what you have to do. You know, they've improved. You know, they've signed an offensive lineman from the Giants. They got a starting center, which is really important for them. And, you know, they get a guy, you get a pass rusher, you get somebody to come in and help your defense as an outside backer. I mean, look, Tampa, what's going to matter most for Tampa is can the corners come through for them? I mean, that's going to be really key. You know, they got Dean, but they're going to have a lot of new corners. The fifth rounder, McCollum from 22, is going to have to play. Smith this year, who they drafted in the third round, is going to have to play. They're going to need to make sure they can play man-to-man because that's something that Todd Bowles wants to do.
We're talking to Michael Lombardi of the book Football Done Right. It's an amazing book. He's on VSiN, but also I can encourage you. This is one of the best football books I've read, and I love the list. I like lists and writing about decisions on the coaches and on players. But another question, Michael, would be the running backs and the Cowboys. And we saw today they signed Ezekiel Elliott again. They brought him back. But I just kept waiting for them to draft like Blake Corum or something, yeah. And it just didn't happen. I was sitting next to, I think, the biggest person of the Blake Corum fan club, and they're like, why are they drafting Blake Corum? He's like, seemed perfect for that team.
Yeah, you know, but I think Corum, you know, one of the things you have to do when you evaluate running backs, and not many people talk about this, is running backs today in 2024, you evaluate them by blocking, catching, running. It used to be, when I was growing up, it was running and running and running. Those are the three criteria. You got to run the ball. But today, it's about blocking, pass protection blocking, catching the ball out of the backfield, and then running. And I think Corum is really a good runner, and I love the kid to death, but I think he was limited in terms of what can he bring to the passing game. I think that's something that needs to be figured out. And then when you break down, you know, I mean, look, the Cowboys must really like Deuce Vaughn, and I like Deuce Vaughn, but what we don't know as fans is sometimes they may be higher on a player than we think they are, and I think that happens to be the case with Deuce.
Were you surprised that Harbaugh did not take more Michigan players to the Chargers? I mean, I was there at the draft, so I was around a lot of Michigan fans, Michigan play. You know, that was a theme. You know, whenever a Michigan player was selected, you know, they had so many players drafted, but people thought Harbaugh, he took two. He took Colson and Cornelius Johnson in the last round. But I think people were thinking every time the Chargers were up, they're like, oh, he's going to take another Michigan player or something like that.
Yeah, I thought so too, you know, but I think he did a good job of really just taking bias out of it. Because I think sometimes when you have a guy, you get too comfortable with them. I mean, why is no one asking Jim Harbaugh, since the great Atlanta Falcons picked a quarterback after they signed one, why didn't they pick J.J. McCarthy if that strategy's so smart?
Yeah, no, I said the same thing. I'm like, well, then just draft every quarterback. I mean, under the philosophy that Atlanta had, I think Rattler and all the other quarterbacks, if the quarterback position is so important, then just draft everybody
at
quarterback.
Just keep drafting them, no matter how many you have, because you got two Rolexes, you can't wear them.
Because someone would, right. I mean, that is the statement, right? Why did, you know, just get, I mean, because again, Penix is 24, he'll be 26. So those cases. But Michael, thank you so much for coming on. I just really appreciate your insight into the draft and your book and everything about it. So thanks a lot for coming on IRA Sports. I really appreciate
it. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Awesome stuff there with Michael Lombardi here on IRA on Sports. And IRA, I do love that he mentioned Trevor Lawrence. And he might be the only person in the world who agrees with me that maybe Trevor Lawrence isn't this great generational talent like we thought.
I just threw Trevor Lawrence out. I didn't realize that was going to... That is definitely between
it.
You two, the nerve that it hits when I bring Trevor Lawrence up. I mean, I put Trevor Lawrence up in that elite category. And, you know, I didn't realize that Trevor Lawrence is like a backup quarterback category.
I didn't realize an NFL GM agreed with me on this, but my most controversial comment ever. I got Michael Lombardi in my corner. It's Iron Sports.
And he does not like Jacksonville's draft, or I think how Jacksonville does anything. So
it's Iron Sports, True Oldies Channel. I'm Mike Balsamo. Let's switch over to the NBA. Ira, playoffs are rolling and things are maybe not necessarily shaping out the way people thought. I mean, we've got some teams that had championship aspirations that are either out or on their way out.
Well, I think I call the changing the guard. The Curry and the Warriors, they did not make the playoffs. LeBron is down 3-1. They played tonight. Durant was swept. He's out. Giannis and Lillard look like they're about to be knocked out. They're both hurt. And Bede's down 3-1. And Jimmy Butler and the Heat, they're down 2-1. So a lot of these teams that we see in the finals every year and with these, you know, the experienced veterans are struggling. And then you look at the new stars, like last night, Anthony Edwards from Minnesota.
Huge.
Wow. Anyone, just Google the dunk he had last night. Oh my gosh, over Kevin Durant. It was great. But it's not just the dunk, it was the take. He took over that game and closed out that game. And SGA of Oklahoma City's had a great playoff so far. Brunson of the Knicks, great playoff so far. And Halliburton of Indiana has played not as great, but at least Indiana look like they're poised to advance to the next round. So you're seeing some of the new stars in the league really take over and sort of like saying, we're not waiting to, you know, we're just going to take it. Like, and I love the fact of how Edwards played against Durant and the veterans like Booker and Beal and just took over that game last night. It was pretty impressive.
So let's talk about our hometown Miami Heat. And this is a series. Right now it's 2-1. After the game two, the Heat managed to steal a game in Boston. They get the win. And I think that people in South Florida were like, it might happen. Like, we've done this plenty of times before. But then, you know, sure enough, in game three, took the win right out of their sails.
Both these teams, at Boston only lost a couple games all year. And for the Heat to win that, I mean, they were a 15-point underdog in the game. And they shot tremendous. I mean, they shot 50% from the field and 54% from three. Jovic was 3-for-4. Kyle Martin, 5-for-6. Kyle Martin should just play all his games at Boston. Like, they should just sign him because he doesn't do anything during the year. And then he comes to Boston, has these amazing games, as you saw in game seven last year. Hero was 6-and-11. Jaime Jaquez is 3-for-6. Robinson had 2 threes. Highsmith, 3 threes. They set the all-time record for threes for the Heat in the playoffs. And it's almost like you're watching the game and you're like, when's it going to end? Like, when is this going to come? Boston's going to come back. And they actually, from beginning to end, shot well and were able to hold on. And it was again 102-96 with the Heat with 3 minutes to go, and Martin hit another three. But I was really impressed. That was a huge win for the Heat. And you're like, wow, they really have figured this out, how to shoot threes, because last year they were a good three-point shooting team. They went to plus and they became the superstar three-point shooting team. So you did feel like, wow, they might be able to pull this all off. And then
game three
game three on Saturday was just unbelievable. Boston won 104-84, total blowout. It was 21-12 at the end of one, 63-39 at halftime. They're up by 29 points. And now Boston is now 15-4 in games immediately after a loss. And they're averaging, after they lose, 12 points a game. And the Heat were just 9-for-28 from three. And now we're going to go for tonight's game, which we're broadcasting. I'll be down here in Miami for that game. Boston's a 10.5-point favorite in Miami. Now remember, there's no Butler, no Rozier. And I just want to say the thing about the Heat, though. I love the way that Jovic is playing. He's 20 years old. He is playing great. And against the Bulls, he plays on Vukovic, and then he jumps down and plays a guard. And Jaime Jaquez, the way he plays is great. Between those two, I'm glad they did not make the trade for Lillard, because I love these two young players. They are playing so great, and they have such. And Hero is really stepping up and playing fantastic. So, I just wish. I mean, this to me, if they could have got that 7 seed, that Sixer game, they would have played the Knicks. I think if Butler would have been healthy and Rozier was going to be healthy, I think this team could have played. I wish we were playing the Celtics in the Eastern Conference Finals, not the first round.
It's kind of interesting. Pat Riley gets more out of those picks in the teens than any GM in the league.
The NFL should hire him to be picking these picks too.
I mean, yeah, like everyone wants those top three picks. Pat Riley's like, give me 14. I'll nail it all star. It's incredible.
And he made the smart move, is where the Phoenix Suns make all these trades to get Kevin Durant and Bradley Beal. He doesn't make that trade for Lillard. The trades you don't make are sometimes the most valuable trades that you make, and he doesn't make that trade, and now look how well these players are playing.
Yeah. Let's talk about Cleveland and Orlando, because this is probably the most competitive series in the East.
It was competitive in terms of being 2-2, but it was crazy. The game one, the Cavs won easily by 14. They won game two. Cavs had a 22-point lead. I'm like, I didn't even want to pay attention going to Orlando. I thought, well, Orlando's going to get blown out. And the Magic win by 30-some points. It was insane in terms of 121-83. At one point, they were down by 43 points, the Cavaliers were. You know, what a terrible performance to come in there and just to be so terrible. And Magic were down by 7, and they made 34 of the next 52 points. And then you're thinking, okay, well, the Cavs will bounce back in game 4. And they were leading at game 4, 60-51. And then they collapsed again in the second half. The Magic went on a 37-10 run, and they end up winning by 24 points. So it was really one of those things. Now, it's 2-2 in the series. You've got to think that Cleveland is the better team. J.B. Bickerstaff, they lost the series to the Knicks before. The talent on the Cavaliers is just amazing with Garland and Mitchell and Mobley and Allen and Max Strus. But boy, just to be 2-2 in this is the Magic are playing hard. Those are two really big wins for the Magic.
So then let's talk about the Pacers and the Bucks. And this is one a lot of hardcore NBA fans are just not happy right now that the Bucks are basically, you know, back to the wall, facing elimination, down 3-1 to the Pacers.
You know, Indiana made some moves. You got to give them credit. They traded Sabonis, who was an all-star center, for Halliburton. Sabonis has played great for Sacramento, but they needed the point guard in Halliburton. And they made the trade this year for Pascal Siakam from Toronto. And Siakam has fit in perfectly with his team. And now they're playing the Bucks. Now the Bucks don't have, you know, Lillard played great the first two games, then he's been out with an injury. Giannis has not played the entire series, and now they're down 3-1. And that was like, you know, again, it was like the game three was the key game. It was 121-118. Chris Middleton was just amazing. He made a 30-foot shot to tie it to send to overtime. In overtime, Aaron Nesmith made a shot. Middleton came back, made a banked from shot, and then Halliburton did this crazy layup to win the game. So you're seeing like guys like SGA, Halliburton, and Anthony Edwards all hit these near game-winning shots to win the game. And then game four yesterday, no Giannis, Lillard was out, and then Portis, the other player, one of their other starters, was ejected in the first like 2 minutes of the game. So it was amazing they were able to stay in the game. They ended up losing by 13. The Bucks are now, I mean, the Pacers are up 3-1. They're headed to Milwaukee. Probably should close out the series. I can't believe they're going to play Lillard or Giannis or anything. And then Giannis will complain or whatever. I mean, this Milwaukee has really not done anything since they won the championship. And Giannis has, you know, not even played in these playoff games.
They fired a few coaches.
And the Doc Rivers. I mean, they were 30-13 with Adrian Griffin when the year started. They fired him and brought in Doc Rivers. And it's just been a disaster, you know, a dumpster fire since then. And it's been a disaster, you know, for them. But for the Pacers, look, it looks like the Pacers and the Knicks would advance to play each other next series.
This is Iron Sports, Drew Oldie's channel. I'm Mike Balsamo. We only have about 10 minutes, so we have to get to Davey Wheels, professional horse handicapper, to break down the Kentucky Derby. So we got to fly here, but got to talk about my New York Knicks, Ira. This is exciting. I mean, they've taken over New York City once again. They took over Philly in games there. It's a good time to be a Knicks fan. I'm excited about this.
Yeah, they had game one, the Knicks won 111-104, and then in game two, the Knicks win 104-101, but clearly it was one of the most amazing comebacks of all time. It was absolute complete collapse by the Sixers. They were up 101-96 with like a minute to go. Brunson was driving around, fumbled the ball. He picked it up. Dante Vincenzo passed it back to him. He made a three. So then it cut down to, you know, cut down to two. And then the Sixers still had the ball, but then they inbound the ball. Lowry turns his back. The timing was off. It was a mess. They didn't call timeout. Nurse said, I should have called timeout. They didn't call timeout. They inbounded. Maxey then turns the ball over, and then they go and they hit. And then again, in Brunson, it's another shot. So at that, or Dante DiVincenzo hits a shot from the top of the key for a three to take over the lead. But what just absolutely, you know, after he missed one and then made it, Hartenstein got the offensive rebound. And you look at these end of the games, the Sixers are getting dominated by the Knicks. Hartenstein is outplaying Embiid in the fourth quarter, but that was a huge win. But Philly comes back to Philadelphia and wins 125-114. Embiid was a huge game. He had, you know, 50 points, a tremendous, you know, one of the greatest performances. But at one point, he pulled down Mitchell Robinson, probably should have been ejected from the game. But then yesterday, they go back another great hard-fought game. The Knicks win 97-92 to take the 3-1 lead. And really, at the end of the game, Maxey missed a shot. Embiid misses a shot. And Embiid was 0-for-5 in the fourth quarter. In the second game, he's been 0-for-5. They got out-rebounded. And you really like what Brunson. You know, Brunson, the first two games, shot poorly. But in games four, you know, he really came through. He set an all-time Knicks record in terms of points in the game. He had 47 points and 10 assists, breaking Ewing's record and Bernard King's record. So Brunson, what a win. And then, you know, Embiid's worried about there were too many Knicks fans in the game. Like he's saying,
dude.
It's like, you know what, don't, you know, it's whatever. It is what it is. But, you know, complaining about the Knicks fans at the game, they're going to go back to the Garden tomorrow and probably the Knicks, you know, we'll see. This has been a hard-fought series both ways. But the
physical series.
And the fact that Embiid, though, in the fourth quarter, everyone's saying he's got to, I mean, that's why I think he should come down to Miami, because he's got to get into the shape to play in this. And I think under the Riley Spoelstra system, he'd be in better shape and to hang in there longer and be able to play in these fourth quarters, because these games are great. Like that, this is a must-watch game in terms of how they play. But Brunson is really coming out, and the Knicks look like, if they can advance through this up 3-1, play the Pacers, and you're going to get maybe the Knicks-Celtics in the Eastern Conference Finals.
I think the Knicks can win a game or two versus the Celtics. I'm not just handing them the East.
The ticket
East.
Prices
the
for those games at the Garden. I mean, for tomorrow night's game, the cheapest ticket is $350 for the game.
Yeah.
I mean, the Knicks fans are going crazy for the Knicks.
Love it, love it. Let's go to the West here. Oklahoma City's pretty much ready to bury New Orleans.
Well, without Zion, I thought New Orleans would put up much of, you know, the first game was close, but the second games were 124-92, and then they won 106-85. So they won by like 30 points the last two games. Total blowouts. These games have not been close. I've been really disappointed with what New Orleans, the performance. They really did not come to play, you know, in terms of these games. And, you know, for a team that beat Sacramento to advance to the playoffs, they just, they're getting blown up. And Oklahoma City, which looked a little like nervous about the playoffs that first game, boy, have they fit in. I mean, you have SGA every game scoring 25, 30 points. Chet Holmgren is playing great. You know, he's only 21. SGA is 25. Jalen Williams is 23. They're younger than like the NC State team was last year. Like they're younger than college team. Josh Giddey is 21. Luke Dork is 25. And they have a zillion draft picks. Talk about a team that's like primed for everything. They have all these draft picks. And like someone said, well, they'll trade for Kevin Durant. Like, they don't need to trade for Kevin Durant. They have all these great young players that are getting better, and they're going to be able to draft better players, too.
Let's talk about Dallas and the Clippers. We're knotted up at two games apiece.
This is truly one of the most exciting series. That game yesterday was awesome to watch. But the Clippers won the first game. No Kawhi Leonard. They're 2-0 with Kawhi. With they don't have Kawhi Leonard when he's out, and they're 0-2 when he plays. The Clippers won that first game. In the second game, Dallas won 96-93, and Kawhi came back. But the Clippers were up 6 with 10 minutes to go, but Dallas was able to come back and win it. And, you know, between Kyrie has played so well these playoffs with Luka, and they made these changes. They brought in P.J. Washington and Daniel Gafford. They're like, who's P.J. Washington from Charlotte and Daniel Gafford from Washington? But they have fit perfectly with Kyrie. It's like a team is saying, this is what we have. We have Kyrie and we have Luka. What can we add? Gafford's been the center doing everything, and P.J. Washington too. So these are great moves they add. And then game 3, Dallas won 101-90, and you're thinking, okay, now they're set. You know, they're up 2-1. They're going to go up 3-1. But boy, game 4, they started out so poorly. They were down 39-16 by the Clippers. George, Paul George, and Harden were just scoring all over the place. And then Kyrie just went off, had an amazing game. He had 40 points, one of the best games I've seen him play, 14 for 25 shooting, 6 for 12 from threes. And it got to be 100-100 with 4:39 left. And then James Harden comes up with these big playoff performances and makes some baskets, which was pretty cool. So that was, it's 2-2. This is definitely going to be a 7-game series between these two teams.
Let's talk about Denver and the Lakers here. Denver's up 3-1. And this is one, I thought it was going to be a sweep. I thought Denver was going to run them off the court, but it hasn't been like that yet. It's been kind of an odd series.
You were right, and a lot of other people said, I think the Lakers are playing fantastic. They're getting amazing performances out of AD. He's averaging 31 points and 16 rebounds. LeBron is not 38, 39 years old. He's 27 points, 8 assists, 6 boards. He's played great. The Lakers have led 139 minutes of the series. Denver's only led 41, and the Lakers have had double-digit leads in all four games.
It's insane.
The first three, they blew them, and it's like, you know, they lost the first game, 114-103. The second game, Denver won. This was the game of the playoffs. This is where the Lakers had it. LeBron, at the end of the game, he just went and took the ball from Jamal Murray and dunked the ball down. He was hitting threes, layups, great performances, and Denver was going there making plays. Michael Porter Jr. made a three after Aaron Gordon threw it back to him, and then at the end of the game, LeBron misses a three, and Jamal Murray, with no time left on the clock, drains a shot to win it. But that, to me, that last fourth quarter was amazing. But anyone who thinks LeBron is done, this, he is playing at a level that, I mean, it's unbelievable. He's using all his intelligence, and he's so athletic and making plays, and he's shooting better now than he's ever shot. He's like shooting like Michael Jordan at the end of his career. So that was a big win for Denver. And then they go to game 3. Again, they had, LA was in the up 12 in the third, and they blew that again. And the Denver came back, and they actually ran away with the game at the end, up by 7. D'Angelo Russell had a terrible game. Gordon, Jokic, Porter, and Murray. I mean, the big four for Denver were dominant. Jokic is, the series is just showing how he's by far the MVP of the league, the best player in the league. Another great time. But I'll tell you, in game 4, they've lost, I think it was at that point, 11 games in a row. They were swept last year. They lost the regular season game, but the Lakers came back and they got a lead and they held it. LeBron, 30 points, AD, 25 points, and 23 boards in the game. So now they go back to Denver for game 5. No one's giving the Lakers much of a shot, but anybody with LeBron in the playoffs, who knows?
So in the final series in the West, Minnesota and the Phoenix Suns, and one thing I love is when Kevin Durant loses, and it's even better when he gets swept, and that's exactly what happened with the team, versus the T-Wolves.
I saw a stat, I couldn't believe it. Kevin Durant in the last 21 playoff games with the Brooklyn Nets and the Phoenix Suns is now 6-15. I mean, 6-15 in 21 games. I mean, that is unbelievable. The Suns had won all 3 regular season games. People thought this series was going to be really tight. Minnesota blew them out by 25 points the first game. In the second game, they won by another 12 points. And then in game 3, Minnesota goes to Phoenix and totally blows them out. Anthony Edwards, 36 points, just a complete disaster. And then last night, Edwards started out slow. Booker was hot. Booker ended up with 49 points. Durant played well. Durant had 33 points. But Anthony Edwards in that fourth quarter, who had said, 9 points in the first half, had 31 in the second. But it was just these big three-point shots and the dunk over Durant and just taking over the game. And Chris Finch, the coach of Minnesota, got run over with a minute and a half to go in the game and got in Taurus Botello. I've never seen a coach like injured. And the assistant coach had to come, and I think it's Micah Norrie, stepped in when the game was still in the balance and still led them to the victory. But the sweep of Phoenix, just amazing. When they put Beal together and they put Durant with Booker, everyone thought, wow, that's amazing, all that offense. But it hasn't played out. And Minnesota, when they put Gobert and Towns and Edwards, it has worked. I got to give the coach, Chris Finch, tremendous credit. And Towns and Gobert has played tremendous together, and Edwards. But I think the key thing is that Towns has deferred to Edwards. He knows Edwards is a superstar, and I love how anyone has got to watch how Minnesota plays. They are so much fun to watch.
This is Iron Sports, Trulli's channel. I'm Mike Balsamo. Davey Wheels from TVG joins us in just a moment to talk Kentucky Derby. But NHL real quick, Ira, it's kind of wild here. We may see no series go to six games. It could potentially happen. We've already seen the New York Rangers sweep Washington. Carolina's about to put away the Islanders. A team that I do feel bad for is Dallas has kind of drawn the worst possible eight seed in Vegas, which is a very good team. They're struggling. One thing I'm very happy about, our Florida Panthers have, for years, Tampa Bay has just been a thorn in their side. They've been like the redheaded stepchild of Florida to Tampa Bay. They're up 3-1 in a position to move on as well. They're also going to face the winner of Boston-Toronto, which to me is a much easier series than facing the Rangers or Carolina, which would be the other part of the East. So might be looking at Florida cruising back to an Eastern Conference Finals and maybe the Cup.
One interesting thing is that tonight the Panthers are playing and also the Heat are playing. The cheapest Panther ticket is like, what, $115, $120? The cheapest Heat ticket is like $65. So it shows that the NHL down here, there's more, it's tougher, the Panther ticket is tougher than the Heat ticket.
I would have never ever anticipated that.
I noticed that when I was looking at those things, I thought it was pretty cool.
This is Iron Sports, True Oldies channel. I'm Mike Balsamo. Time to bring in Davey Wheels. You know him as an analyst from TVG, professional horse handicapper, here to break down everything Kentucky Derby. I love this time of year, Wheels, because we get close, and you know all the prep races are exciting, but once we get to this big three across 5 weeks, there's really nothing else like it in sports.
It's the greatest spectacle in sports, in my mind. They say that about the Indy 500. I believe it's the Kentucky Derby. It's the greatest, 2 minutes in sports, for sure.
So let's talk a little bit about the post positions here. And I'm looking into this, and we see the favorites, the horse that people like, Sierra Leone, and he draws the 2 box. And then you've also got Fierceness, who draws the 17. And everything I'm reading and hearing, Dave, is that these are not good post positions. It's going to be really tough for them to win from there, but you might think something different.
I completely disagree. And if you listen to the experts online, and I was listening to Mike Welsh, Fierceness couldn't have drawn better. He's the controlling speed. So he drew outside of everybody that's going to try to run for the lead. Like, for example, Dornock, the horse on the rail. He's only one in lead, so he has to go to the front from the rail. He might have had bad post position, but Fierceness, you want to be the controlling speed and have everybody else inside of you. So I think he drew great. He's going to break, and he's going to probably settle second or third or wherever he wants to. He drew very well.
So we've talked about... Go ahead, Dave.
I'm sorry. But as far as Sierra Leone, he's a dead closer. He's going to have 15 to 19 horses in front of him. Tyler Gaffleone, after the break, is going to settle in on the rail, going into the first turn. And he's just got to pick them up and mow them down. That's his style. He comes from dead last and puts on a huge run. The only issue with him now, and this would be whether he was in post 2 or post 10, post 15, it doesn't matter. He's got to avoid tiring horses in front of him when he makes his big move. So a jockey has to sit real chilly on the horse, find the right holes, and sometimes it pays off and you win. Sometimes you have to pull up, and if you have to check badly in the Derby, you're not going to come back and win.
And Wheels, one of the things, I know professional handicappers like you love the Derby because you're getting money into this pool that normally would never be there. It's the most bet race of the year. But something I don't like about this is the massive field. And we're seeing, favorites at things like 3-1. That just doesn't get me excited. If they win, you're not going to get paid big on it. You got to try to find a way to get some of those bombs in there. One of them I'm looking at is Just Steel. He's going to run out of the 6. He's about a 20-1 shot. What do you think of Just Steel, and what are some of maybe the other longer plays that you're going to mix in your exotics?
Sure. I've got a couple of them for you here. Jeff Steele has a chance to hit the board. I believe that there's only maybe five or six horses that can truly win this race. And I believe Sierra Leone and Fierceness have a big, big chance. But Bombs have run second and third almost every year in this race if the favorite wins. You can go back, Commanding Curve was 50-1, ran second to one of the favorites. So you're always going to get prices in this race. And I believe this, Mike, because the other horses that have legit shot, they take their shot and they run up the track. And so it's going to bring the Bomb. So I think if Fierceness wins this race, you're going to see a Bomb second or at least third. So you got a big chance to make some money. As you said earlier, though, you've got so many people betting colors, they're betting names, their favorite numbers. That's why it's the greatest race of the year. And then having 20 horses, it just makes the payout so huge. But I got a couple long shots for you. And the first one is Encino. Now, Encino won the Lexington a few weeks ago. And I know they were hesitant to run him, but he's working so well that he drew into the race, and that's Brad Cox as his trainer. He knows how to get horses ready for big races. So I think he's 20-1 morning line. He's worth a few bucks because he's regally bred, and he can get the distance. His father, Nyquist, won the Derby, and Bernardini's his dam sire. He's been the dam sire of multiple Kentucky Derby winners. And then one more horse for you, and I know the Wood Memorial hasn't put out a lot of winners lately, but a horse named Resilience, that's Junior Alvarado and Bill Mott, looked really good winning the Wood Memorial, and I think he can sit right behind Fierceness. And you're going to get all 20-1 on him, maybe even more. Those are a couple of good long shots to play.
And Wheels, I know Ira's going to talk to you in a minute about the Risen Star, but you got, you know, the Risen Star, the Florida Derby, these big prep races that come up, you know, right in time for the, you know, these horses' last race before they're going to run in the Kentucky Derby. What's your prep, though? How do you, you know, look into these races that these horses have run? Because a lot of them haven't run that much. They're 3 years old. How do you prep and try to handicap this race going back to their prior races like the Florida Derby and the Risen Star?
Well, the Risen Star is turned into, as of lately, become one of the really good races because Fairgrounds has really turned into, other than the Florida Derby, probably the best prep track. And we've got a lot of horses from that field. Now, I look at the way, it doesn't really matter where they run, it's how they run. And like, for example, you got Jess Steele, the horse you mentioned. I'm not crazy about, but I think he can hit the board. What I like about him is he's got 6, 7, 8. He's got almost a dozen starts, where a lot of these horses, some only have 3 or 4 starts. So he certainly has the experience. Dwayne Lucas is known to really work hard, horses real hard. So it takes a very sound horse to be able to keep up with Dwayne. Now, his sire is Justify. He won the Triple Crown, so we know he can get the distance. He's got a young jockey, Keith Asmussen, on him. But he, you know what? He's another horse. Throw a few bucks on him. Crazier things have happened. But I think more he's a second and third, fourth type of horse. But it's going back to the Florida Derby has been the best prep race for the past 20 years. More Florida Derby winners have won the Kentucky Derby. And then Fairgrounds, Oaklawn, they seem to be the second and third choice as far as preps. As far as what I look at, I look at horse form, how they're working going into the Kentucky Derby. There's been a lot of favorites that I shied away from because I heard they weren't in great form, because sometimes horses are worked so hard just to get to the Derby, they run a flat race in the Derby, and it's obviously the first time they're running against 19 other horses.
Yeah, well, especially with how it is now, where it's not, you don't enter them. You have to accumulate points to get there. So you might have a horse that's short on points that needs to, you know, go all out in the race prior to get himself in. Yep. So it's an interesting
Bandini,
way to look at it.
Bandini was a perfect example of that. He had to win the Lexington, and he was my first toss that year because they were all out to get in the Derby, and he was my first toss.
Ira, what do you have for Davey Wheels?
He ran up the track. Yep.
Wheels, thanks a lot for coming on. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Fierceness, Florida Derby winner, owner's Mike Rapoli. He had 2011, he had a heavy favorite, Uncle Mo, was scratched. And then Forte, another favorite last year, was scratched. So, you know, the Fierceness comes up as the favorite in this race. You would like to think that, wow, he can get through this and like get to the starting gate.
Yeah, hopefully. And he's in the post 17, and people made a big deal about nobody's ever won from the 17 post. I went back and looked at the horses that drew from the 17 post, and there were a couple good ones, but became great later on in their career. Loy Aron's a perfect example. The only real true horse that could have won the Derby from the 17 post was Point Given. He ended up winning the Preakness and the Belmont, but he didn't like the track that day. So disregard the curse of the 17 post. I've heard Fierceness is working phenomenal. And I hate to bet favorites in the Derby, but that might be where my money is if I can get 5-2.
I watched this morning, I watched the Risen Star Stakes. That was Sierra Leone, Track Phantom, Chasing Freedom, and Resilience, four horses that are in the race. And it was actually a close ending. You know, when you looked at the racing form, but you actually watched the race, they were all, Sierra Leone did not run away with this. I mean, it came in, it was a closing, but it looked like, so I would not say that Track Phantom, Chasing Freedom, and Resilience were bad horses because they were right neck and neck with Sierra Leone.
It's funny you say that, Ira. That's a great observation. If you like Sierra Leone, you got to like Track Phantom because he was right there with them. And sometimes in these races, it's just a head bob. So do you want 3-1 or do you want 16-1? You know, I'm just guessing on odds there. So I would tell people, demand value. And that's the Risen Star is a great, the Florida Derby and the Risen Star would be the two preps I'd really look at.
And the one, you know, Forever Young is a Japanese horse, the UAA Derby winner. Nobody, you know, Japanese horses have not won. The UAA Derby winner is not one. But people say this could be, people really like this Forever Young horse.
Yeah, and they've been saying that, Mike will tell you, for the past, what, 5-6 years. Until one beats me, I'm not going to play him.
Ira, me and Wheels have been throwing out the foreign horses for a decade, like he said. All the hype coming in, and they just never seem to even hit the board.
Oh, okay.
And the wise guy horse too, never wins either.
Wise guy never wins, never.
So Justify has two horses in this, Just Steal and Just a Touch. So that is interesting that you have Justify, who, as we know, a Triple Crown winner, has two sires in the race. And Big Brown, who is a grandfather of one of the horses in the race.
Yeah. Phenomenal. He won from the 20 hole. So if you've got speed, post position really doesn't matter. When all said and done, if you're a closer, you better be in the right position to make your run.
One last question, Wheels, is the fact that the post positions were drawn early. How much earlier were they drawn this year than the years past?
They did it on Saturday night, Ira, and that's the first time ever. Normally, the horses have to be on the ground, and then they would draw on Wednesday, like at 5:00. So 2 days from now, they do it at 5 p.m. So I was shocked to see that they had to. First of all the horses had to be on the ground a week early, which is good because people want information and you don't want trainers just bringing them the day before. So people want to see the horses. And second, they do the post position. And I think this is good because we all know where the horses are breaking from now. And it just gives us 3 more days to handicap.
3 more days to handicap, but also for the owners and trainers and the jockeys. Is it a way for them to plan differently?
Absolutely. You're right, for sure. Because if you're breaking from a certain post, it's really who's outside of you, who's inside of you. Like I said earlier, if you're a speed horse and you've got speed to the inside of you, maybe you change your tactics to where you've been drawn.
So who is your final top? You have Fierceness. I think you're picking Fierceness.
I'm going to go with Fierceness 1. I'm going to throw Encino, mm-hmm. Long Shot number 2. And let's go with Just a Touch 3rd.
All right. Thanks a lot, Wheels. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure, guys. Appreciate you.
Ira on Sports, Drew Oldie's channel. I'm Mike Balsamo. Ira, Formula One is here. This is a massive event. You've been there before. You know what kind of spectacle you're getting into.
I've been here. This is the 3rd year they've had it here in Miami, and it just keeps getting better. It's going to be great. I'll be there Friday for the time trial, Saturday for the practices, which anybody should go to. I think it's almost as much fun to go on Friday, Saturday than it is Sunday for the race itself. So I'm pumped. It's great, and it's a great atmosphere, and we'll talk about it next week on I Run Sports.
Do you know where you're planning on setting up? I remember like the first time you went, it was like you didn't know if you were in the right spot. Did you kind of have it figured out?
Well, I have a media pass for this year, so we should be able to be able to move around and get to see certain things. Every year I sort of see it a little differently, but I'm so excited to be, as you know, I'm one of the biggest Formula One fans, and I'm just with Jonathan Clegg on the show a couple weeks ago talking about this race. You know, Matthew Verstappen, you know, is probably going to dominate again, but it'll be fun to be at this race, and I just encourage anybody to come down and just come on Friday and Saturday. You do not have to come to the race because there's those practice sessions are sometimes just more fun to watch than even the race itself.
Let's get caught up in golf.
Two golf events, Rory McIlroy and Shane Lowry won the team competition in Zurich Open, which is, you know, PJ said we don't like the team concept, but they have it. And then LIV Golf Adelaide, it's probably one of LIV Golf's biggest events, and 94,000 people in Australia, super popular. Brendan Steele won it for the High Flyers, and Phil Mickelson was giving him some advice at the end. It shows, you know, the captains of the team so that he won that. And then also the Ripper GC, the Australian team, won in a playoff that's led by Cameron Smith. So you had the team concept, and then Brendan Steele won it. And some golfers said, well, you know, the PGA Championship is just 2 weeks away. John Rahm finished third. He was two shots off. And Brooks Koepka played very well. He's only a few strokes off, was ninth. And Cam Smith also had a good day. And also Bryson, too. There were some of these golfers that we like to, you know, bet in the majors that had some good, you know, looked like they're in form, especially Brooks. I think Brooks, after the Masters performance, is looking to bounce back in front of the PGA Championship, which he's won twice.
He did it last year. So we're looking forward to that. We're out of time, though. Thanks so much to Michael Lombardi, Davey Wheels. He's Ira on Mike. Let's talk next Monday night, Iron Sports.